It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. And today on the show, ideas about leadership and how who we think looks like a leader is changing.
I was very shy and quiet and very studious as a child and as a teenager. So I think people would never have believed that I would go on to do the job that I'm doing.
This is Scotland's first minister and first ever female leader, Nicola Sturgeon.
The most important lesson that I learned from my mum and dad was to follow your dreams. Never let anybody tell you that you couldn't have a go at doing what it was you wanted to do.
Nicola is undoubtedly a political prodigy. At age 16, she joined the Scottish National Party. At 21, she became the youngest candidate in Britain's general election. She is now Scotland's longest-serving First Minister. But the path to being in charge was very difficult. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you lost your first 7 elections. Is that right?
I think I stopped counting, but that's probably true. But you know what? That was the best. These were the best lessons I could ever have learned. Because you learn about yourself. You develop a degree of resilience. You learn to work out why you had lost and what you could do better to try to win. Now, of course, in politics and in party politics and elections, it's never just down to you as an individual that you lost an election. It's about, you know, the standing of your party and the general political context. But nevertheless, you still have a responsibility to bring something of yourself to that. And those losses, I don't think I'd be where I am today had I not suffered all of those losses.
I mean, to push past those losses, I hate it, but the word that comes to mind for me is ballsy. But you were given a different nickname at the time.
Was that Nippy Sweetie?
Yes, Nippy Sweetie.
Yeah.
Which, Nippy is not a nice word, though,
well,
right?
Well, you see, Nippy Sweetie is a Scottish term, obviously. And it, in its negative sense, means somebody who's, you know, a bit kind of grumpy and bad-tempered and bossy and strident, not particularly pleasant, I suppose. But the nickname was given to me by a guy who I think the world of. He was a trade union official in the shipyard in the constituency I was contesting at the time. And he meant it in its positive sense. He meant it as somebody who was ballsy, who stood up for what she believed in, who fought her corner. But in the world of politics, it was immediately taken in its negative sense and used as part of the efforts of my political opponents, elements of the media, to characterise me in a particular way, which lots of young women, I think, encounter in politics and in other walks of life too.
Yeah, so what did you do? Would you, you know, ignore it or laugh at it? Or what was your reaction?
Well, one of the things that I look back on and understand now is when you are a woman, particularly a young woman, in a very, very male environment, in order to be taken seriously, you end up almost emulating the behaviours of the men around you.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of, you know, maybe dressing a bit more severely, behaving in a much more, you know, strident adversarial way. And what I now understand is that in trying to do that, to fit in, you actually play into the stereotype that people are trying to label you with anyway.
Yeah, and you know, you've been in office now a long time, and you've seen what it was like when women were expected to emulate traditionally masculine qualities, maybe strong-arming people. But I'm wondering, after the Me Too movement, did things change? Do you feel like this younger generation is saying, no, we don't want you to use those qualities to lead? In fact, that is not leading anymore.
I think it is changing. I think it's still got a way to go. I think women are finding it easier, perhaps, to be themselves and not to fall into those traps, because it is a trap. What I found was if you weren't behaving like the men around you, you were not taken seriously. But as soon as you started to do that, you were, you know, described as a nippy sweetie and not feminine enough.
Right.
So it's a double bind, a double whammy. And I think we are seeing women now lead in a way that is much more natural and actually, I think, makes for much better leadership. And I'm generalising, I suppose, here. But I think women tend to lead with much more emotional intelligence, with much more, you know, ability to understand the real impacts of the decisions that they are taking. So I think we are seeing that female model of leadership come more to the fore, but we've still got a long way to go.
So let's dive into the two big global issues that you have been tackling in Scotland and in some pretty unique ways. You've actually given two TED Talks on these topics. And the first one is about rethinking GDP as a measure of a country's success.
Yeah. Well, firstly, I think it's time to turn away from GDP as the sole measure of a country's success. I'm not saying it's not important at all to measure our success in that way, but I don't think it's sufficient. I mean, if you take GDP measurements, you know, we don't measure unpaid care, you know, people who look after elderly relatives or children, but we do measure, you know, the proceeds of illegal drug use. So there's something a bit wonky in having that as the sole measure of our success as a country. I believe overall the most important metric is how happy are we.
Here's Nicola Sturgeon on the TED stage.
You know, when we focus on well-being, we start a conversation that provokes profound and fundamental questions. What really matters to us in our lives? What do we value in the communities we live in? What kind of country, what kind of society do we really want to be? In policy terms, this journey for Scotland started back in 2007 when we published what we call our National Performance Framework, looking at the range of indicators that we measure ourselves against. And those indicators are as varied as income inequality, the happiness of children, access to green spaces, access to housing. None of these are captured in GDP statistics, but they are all fundamental to a healthy and a happy society. And that broader... that broader approach is at the heart of our economic strategy, where we give equal importance to tackling inequality as we do to economic competitiveness. It drives our commitment to fair work, our path to a carbon zero economy. We know from economic transformations of the past that if we're not careful, there are more losers than winners. And as we face up to the challenges of climate change and automation, we must not make those mistakes again.
So you mentioned climate change here as something that goes along with building a happier, obviously healthier society. And you actually gave another TED Talk more recently about the role that you and Scotland are trying to carve out for yourselves. At the recent big climate talks, Scotland was the host, but they weren't formally at the negotiating table. So talk to me about how you're trying to position Scotland as a leader on climate change.
Well, I just wanted to do, I suppose, a couple of things. Firstly, make sure Scotland and the Scottish government was doing everything we possibly could in whatever way to contribute to the best outcome from COP26. And we thought very carefully, given that we weren't around the negotiating table in our own right, how could we make a difference? What issues could we choose to champion to try to shift the dial a little bit on them? So that's the first thing I decided we needed to do. But then the other thing I wanted to do was showcase Scotland, because all countries, as we make this transition to net zero, we want to be the places where investment is coming, where the research has been done, where, you know, the innovation is happening. And this was a great opportunity to showcase Scotland to countries and companies and investors from around the world.
You have really, I mean, despite Scotland being a really small country, you have decided to do a few things that other bigger countries are not doing. You announced that Scotland was going to be the first government to contribute to a loss and damage fund, offering money to countries who have faced harm from climate change. But really, like, what? How much of an impact can a country like Scotland really have? You are part of the UK. You are a very small country. What? Where do you see your ability to have real impact on the issue?
Well, first and foremost, we have to lead by example. in what we are doing at home. But I think we demonstrated at COP that small countries can have a big voice. Loss and damage was one of the issues we decided in advance that we were going to champion, because it's just a recognition that climate change, for many countries, they are suffering the loss and damage right now. They're suffering the harm right now. And the countries that are suffering most of that loss and damage are the countries that have done least to contribute to climate change. So those of us in countries like mine, industrialised countries, have a moral obligation to help those countries deal with that.
Small countries have no time for small objectives. And we see examples of the leadership that small countries show everywhere we look. Take Bhutan. 1 million people or thereabouts became the first in the world to commit to being carbon neutral for all time. Since then, 130 countries of all sizes have followed suit. Or Fiji. In 2017, it hosted the UN Climate Conference and did so much to highlight the existential threat that climate change poses to island nations. Now, a country like Scotland, with a rich industrial past, has a special responsibility. We have disproportionately contributed to climate change, so we must do more now to help tackle climate change. So in recent years, Scotland, this small country, has decarbonised faster than any G20 country. We have just become... We have just become the first nation in the world that is not an independent nation yet to publish... an indicative... nationally defined contribution showing how we will meet the objectives of the Paris Agreement. So we've pledged to cut emissions by three quarters by 2030 and to be net zero by 2045. So my point today is that yes, big countries matter, but the leadership of small nations matters too.
I mean, it means rethinking in the entire economy, right? How Scotland functions. We see Germany going through that as it tries to phase out coal and turn to wind. The United States is trying to figure out how to do that. How is Scotland going to do that? Because you have set very, very aggressive goals in terms of reducing your carbon emissions way before other countries have been called to do so.
Well, yeah, I mean, we have, but I would argue that we're only doing what we are required to do in terms of the Paris obligations. In order to play our small part in averting climate catastrophe for the planet. But this is something that it's an obligation for countries everywhere. Every country will have particular challenges. Scotland is a country that has produces oil and gas, so that transition is one of the most difficult for us. Every country has its difficulty, but the alternative to this is climate catastrophe and, you know, not leaving to future generations a planet that is habitable. And that is just, in my view, unthinkable.
First Minister, this sounds like a naive question, but I really am wondering, do you love your job?
Yes. Yeah, I do. But it's not a naive question. What does that mean? I wouldn't do my job if I didn't love it. It is the biggest privilege imaginable to be the first minister of your country, and I love it, and I wouldn't do it if I didn't love it. But that's not to say, I think what makes me sometimes, you know, step back from that question is when you say you love something, it kind of creates this impression that it's really easy, it's a bit of a breeze, and it's always joyful, and none of those things are or should be true about a job like mine. You know, there are some days, particularly in the last 2 years, where it's been, you know, really, really tough, where the decisions have been awful, where I've, you know, really struggled with the magnitude of all of that. So, yes, I love it, but I don't want, in saying that, to create the impression that it is, you know, a walk in the park, because no job like this ever should be or ever could be.
So when we first started talking, We discuss the different challenges that women face as leaders, sometimes the double standards that they have to navigate. And I want to bring up a topic that you have been asked about recently, which is menopause. I mean, on the one hand, it's kind of frustrating that this question is even being put to you in the first place. No male politician would be asked about his body. But on the other hand, as a woman myself, I feel like it's refreshing to hear you be honest about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I've kind of said I will try to do. I'm only beginning to, I suppose, experience what that means in reality and work out how I'm going to deal with it. But I suspect I and most women in positions like mine will find that going through the menopause, you just have to work that much harder to overcome some of this. So, you know, maybe we just get better. I don't know. Maybe having the world ruled by menopausal women would be the best thing for everybody. But I don't mind admitting it's not something that I feel all that comfortable with, when even though I know intellectually there's no reason for me not to feel comfortable with it. Every woman goes through it. But I don't. It's very personal. It's not something that women have been openly talking about yet for very long. So I do feel a little bit nervous and uncomfortable about it. But then I also feel if somebody like me doesn't, you know, open up about what it's like and how I cope with it, then I'm not doing what I could do to make it a bit easier for the next female First Minister of Scotland who might go through this to not feel quite so at sea about it.
Mm. I mean, that's kind of what leadership is, I guess, right? Talking about things that affect everyone when you'd really rather just keep it to yourself.
Yep.
So as you reflect on your many years in government, what do you think? Is leadership changing? Is it changing for the better?
Yeah, I think, I hope leadership is changing in a way and that leaders feel able to be a bit more frank and open about the challenges of leadership, about the fact that leaders are also human beings and human beings are fallible and we make mistakes. And that when we make mistakes, it is much better to acknowledge that and learn the lessons from those mistakes rather than do what politicians have traditionally done, which is never, ever admit to ever making a mistake. And for anybody in a position of leadership, you're developing your approach to leadership all of the time. And the day you stop doing that is probably the day you should give it up. Leadership changes you to some extent. It also reveals a lot about who you are to start with. But it's also the case, I believe, that you should try to learn something from that to make you a better leader in the future.
First Minister, thank you. Thank you so much for your time. I know you have a lot going on.
Thank you. Lovely to talk to you.
That's Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon. You can see both of her talks at TED.com. On the show today, what leadership looks like. I'm Anoush Zamarodi, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.